The following is the first Marine Aircraft Wing taped historical interview. The interviewee is Major Martin W. Meredith, 080505, USMC. Pilot and logistics officer attached to VMFA 314, MAG 13, Chu Lao, Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Corporal Norman R. Carlson, 218-5474, USMC. This interview takes place at Chu Lao, Republic of Vietnam on 2 March 1968. The subject of this interview is BARCAP missions. The events described in this interview occurred during the period of December 1967 to present date. This interview is classified confidential until downgraded by higher authority.
This is Major Maris, and I'll discuss the BARCAP mission. Since it was something new for us at the time, it did present some problems. And the first problem it presented was the aircraft and the radar system, since we've been flying air-to-ground missions almost strictly. Our radar systems weren't kept up in the best of shape due to parts and the need to turn the aircraft around for air-to-ground missions. Thus, the radar wasn't in the best of shape, so we had to work real hard initially to get the radar up to perform the mission when we were told that we were going to get it. We were able to come through, and we planned on, for each mission, for to have two airplanes, as two F-4s accompany the A-6 ECM bird. However, we additionally planned to have three birds go up initially to start the mission, and the best two aircraft would continue on the mission, while the other plane would stay and stand by and then return eventually to July. Aside from the radar systems and the missile systems, getting them ready, we had to get into the planning stages themselves. That is, to get the intelligence brief for up in that area, since we weren't considerably up on the North Vietnamese area. That is, the fields, exact locations of them, the SAM sites, etc., since we weren't operating in that area. So we had an intelligence brief on that. And it proved adequate. However, there were a few items missed, and as we found out later, such as, I believe, one SAM site that wasn't mentioned to us. However, we were able to get it prior to the mission. Somebody on a divert mission to Ubon was able to find it out from the Air Force. That was a new SAM site, but we did get this information prior to the first launch. Next thing was securing maps and making up our maps, and that presented a small problem that there was a minimal supply of maps available for the area, that is, maps that the aviator can use for this particular type mission. However, we were able to secure enough for the people to go, and all it meant was that we just turned in the maps for the next crew to use when they went. And the third thing we had to get on was briefing the crews themselves, since they hadn't flown very much radar missions, which meant for the pilots to review their switchology procedures for launching missiles and the processes for launching the envelopes, etc., and for the radar IOs for them to review quickly their procedures for making intercepts, and then finally determining what type BARCAP we would set up as far as the actual pattern that we'd fly over the ground once we got on station. Okay, you can cut it. Once all these problems were resolved, again, there were problems to the point that it was just that it was a new type mission, and one that not necessarily we couldn't handle, but just one that we had to work a little extra harder at because we weren't doing it every day, and we were able to solve all the problems in order to meet our launch. I'm not sure, but I believe I was on one of the first ones, if not the first one itself. They're scheduled for three of us to go. That is three aircraft, a total of six people on the crew. We briefed early in the morning. I can't remember exact times. Somewhere around, that is the final brief, around 2, landed our aircraft, or around 3, and we're airborne. The weather was not too bad. It wasn't that great, which we'll get into another problem area, that is fuel. Since the weather was IFR, we did have to plan on extra fuel for coming back here in order to divert to Ubon. So it meant that we had to have quite a few extra pounds of fuel aboard. Okay, we taxied and got in position. I was number two, CO was leader, And we had the third airplane as a standby to go with us. All three of us took off as planned. We rendezvoused and proceeded on up to the tanker. We had no problems getting up there, except for the third airplane did experience problems on the ground, so Luna and I commenced our flight on up to the tanker airlock. About when we were halfway up to the tanker, we heard the third airplane check in with the control agency, so we knew that he was airborne at the time. We got into the tanker area. I was able to effect a quick rendezvous on the tanker, since the timeline that radar was marginal and we were in radar tracking. That is, I was following my leader on radar, and we were experiencing radar problems at the time, so we lost him on our radar.
It was quite a black night, and we were that far on radar trail where we were not able to find him visually, so we both proceeded onto the tanker individually. But again, it didn't present any problems.
I was able to get to the tanker quickly and get plugged in and took on my fuel. By the time I was just getting through, my leader was able to plug in. He got to the tanker, and we proceeded on up to our mission area. Because of the delays of getting airborne, as I didn't mention, I had problems with my airplane initially prior to takeoff, and they had to be worked on. And so there was just continuous delays. Getting on the tanker and everything. Apparently we just didn't plan enough time. And I believe the flight itself got up there, just the A6 got up there a little early. So we ended up only getting about three quarters of the way to our cap position when we were notified that the bombers had performed their mission. And so it wasn't necessary for us to continue any further. We turned around and proceeded on back as a leader and myself. In the meantime, the third man, we told him to go on home since at that time both my radars were working better than his leader and myself, and we proceeded on back to re-tank. However, since we didn't have to stay on station, we found him from. That is, we didn't have to stay on the bar cap station very long. Our bingo fuel wasn't met, and so we were able just to dispense with re-tanking on the tanker aircraft, and proceed on back to Tulai. We had plenty of fuel available. However, if we had to stay on station for that period of time, we would have had to have re-tanked on this mission and proceeded back. Now, the other, when I say problems of fuel, we were told, I believe, that the tankers were going to take on 22,000 pounds of fuel, which would be available to us. Now, if all three airplanes had tanked, there wouldn't have been enough fuel for the two airplanes remaining to come back. So we planned the two best radars to tank initially. The two best airplanes had all systems go, and the third airplane would then turn around going back to Tulai. And that's the way it worked on our particular mission. And we got the bonus of the effect that we didn't have to stay on station that long, so consequently we didn't have to use a tanker on the way back. Cut it a second here. During the mission itself, while we were up over North Vietnam, proceeding on towards what they call the South Cap Point, which was southwest of Hanoi, we didn't pick up any targets except for where the A6 ECM bird, and we had established contact with him. However, the radar coverage we had going up, our radar agencies on the way up, were not the best. We lost radar contact with the most important agency. When we got, I'd say about halfway, a little less than halfway past the tanker point, that is the point where we tanked and our cap station. So eventually we were alone by ourselves as far as radar was concerned. Possibly we'd know if we were being attacked by MiGs was the fact that our radar would show it. That's why we proceeded up in the radar trail, and once we were going to go down station, we were going to perform a figure eight pattern, which we thought would probably give us the maximum radar coverage for both of us. That is, putting one man on one end of the figure eight and the other on the other, and we got to cross-check each other that way on the radar. But all in all, the mission as it went smoothly, a lot smoother than you would think at first, based upon the intelligence and more probably just the fact that we hadn't done it before. But after doing it, we learned it quite a bit from it, and didn't appear to present any obtuse problems for us. Next mission I went out on was another bar cap. It was basically the same thing, except the planning wasn't as detailed now because we'd already been on it, and in between my first and second mission, there were quite a few missions, so we were able to cross-tell quite a bit of information between us and learn from it. On the next mission, the same thing, we had three of us get airborne this time. We went on the radar trail. Initially, my radar started having problems, and as we proceeded on up, another man had problems. Fortunately, my radar, by the time we got the tanker, came back
on the line, and we were able to pursue on to the tanker, and two of us tanked. The third man, who lost his radar completely, we bundled him back to tree line. Both of us tanked up and proceeded on up to our target area. We were delayed at the tanker because of one person not being able to tank right away. But we did get through in sufficient time because what we learned in the past to allow a little bit more time for all the procedures and necessities of getting to the on station on time. We did get on station this time, and this is, matter of fact, as we got on station again, the A6 was on time, and he was able to drop his load, bomb load, and we were turned right around and go back. Consequently, we didn't have to stay on station, and we were there just for one turn. We turned right around, came back, and then we didn't have to tank on the way back. We were able to proceed back to July with enough fuel to make it. That is, without bingo fuel available. That's basically the missions. Some of the recommendations that I would like to put in are that people that do come over here, the pilots, get more night tanker time, practice tanker time, than before, because we had experience on a few flights where some people who hadn't had night tanker time had problems getting on a tanker, which could delay as much as 15 minutes on the tanker. Again, some people had to get right on, and others weren't, and even people who had practiced it before had some problems, but it didn't present a great problem. It would just be a little bit better situation if everybody was more familiar with practicing night tanking. What we did for our crews, if we did have someone, a pilot riding the tank before, we put an experienced IO who had done quite a bit of night tanking as his IO. And vice versa, if we had an IO who hadn't night tanked, we had an experienced pilot. Because it's an F4, you have to, it's a team effort. Most pilots tank by using the reference point, that is, they don't try to put the probe itself into the drogue. They use a reference point on the drogue line or on the airplane, some type of reference, and then put it in. And the last few, probably in the last 3 feet, when he makes his final stand for it, the RIO is able to adjust him by, say, moving the side of the airplane to the side of the section, so it helps out having somebody who's done it before, and especially at night. So that's one item that I would strongly recommend, that the crews be fully experienced in night tank time, night refueling operations. It wasn't a problem for us, that is, of having experienced crews. We had plenty of people in the squadron at that time who were fortunate to have been in the States long enough to get quite a bit of time in the F-4, consequently getting quite a bit of air work along with air to ground work, which is not the situation now. We're getting some people in who have had no air to air work and minimal air to ground work. Although we do have a nucleus in each squadron that is capable of handling it, all personnel couldn't handle the job probably adequately at the time, at this time. And this is mostly the RIOs. One thing that I found out myself on this particular type mission, on the way back, I experimented with rather than flying radar trail, in the case that we would lose radar, what possible position would be best to fly in. And I experimented with the old method of flying high section. I've never tried it at night, and in fact, haven't been able to find anybody that has tried it themselves or who has worked at it. And I experimented with flying high, low section type maneuver. That is, moving it out about a mile of beam and up 4,000 or 5,000 feet and trying to maintain a reference on the leader by just using his lights. I was quite surprised that it didn't present as many problems as I thought it would. About the only thing, once, of course, I knew what his airspeed was going to be, and I knew what altitude he was at, and I could just set my speed and altitude, airspeed to correspond with his and the altitude that I desired, and I didn't find any problem at all, except during the turns. If they were unannounced turns, about the only thing I would find out that I would see his airplane eventually starting to move further and further away, the lights getting dimmer, and so then, of course, I knew he was in a turn. However, by using the procedures that I used, that we all learned in daytime, I was able to maintain a position and found that it was an adequate means of flying a defensive-type maneuver, which we have worked with quite a bit in the daytime, but again, we never used at night. Almost all night work we've done is either radar trail or wing position. So, at least to my findings, I believe that the high-low section is a workable solution at night for flying formation and can give you, that is, moving up to the target area and by moving away from the target area, not while you're on bar cap, and an alternate method besides radar trail would be flying high-low section. the summation of the mission itself, then all I can say is that in the beginning, it just took a little extra work on everybody's part to get ready for the mission, and once we'd flown a few times by passing on information to each other, we were able to successfully fly the mission, and to my own feeling, I didn't think there was any great problems in it. About the only other things I'd like to mention is that the crews for this type of mission have to be definitely well qualified, that is a pilot in IO, and radar, missile work, and of course, night work and night refueling work. And in the case of winter time, such as when we were flying ours, and instrument work. But outside of that, I didn't find any major problems. And the missions, at least the ones I flew on, I felt went relatively smooth for the experience we had at the time. I believe that we flew these missions continuously, that it wouldn't present any problem at all. Knowing that we'd have to keep our radars up, of course, this would probably limit some sorties we'd probably be able to do air to ground wise, but maintaining the radar in certain birds to fly these missions. But as far as being able to accomplish the mission, I don't see where it would have presented any problems, or would in the future. Okay.
The following is the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing taped historical interview. The interviewee is Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Hagerman, 057856 USMC, Commanding Officer of VMFA 323, MAG 13, Chu Lai, Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Corporal Norman R. Carlson, 218-5474 USMC. This interview takes place at Chu Lai, Republic of Vietnam on 2 March 1968. The subject of this interview is a close air support mission and the loss of an F-4B aircraft in Khe Sanh area. The events described in this interview occurred on 22 January 1968. This interview is classified confidential until downgraded by higher authority.
This is a statement of Lieutenant Colonel H.T. Hagerman, Commanding Officer of VMFA 323, on the 1st of March, 1968. On 22nd of January, at approximately 14:55, I was leading a primary flight on a hot pad scramble from Chu Lai, Republic of Vietnam. Joyride had a loaded love bug base, indicated to scramble two aircraft to the Khe Sanh area in which I was the lead flight. My RO was Captain Peter Brandon, and the second aircraft had second aircraft was flown by Major Harry Taylor of MABS 13. As we approached the Khe Sanh area, we were directed to contact a forward air controller whose call sign was Smitty Charlie. He indicated that he had a suspected anti-aircraft site south-southwest of the field, approximately 4 miles from Khe Sanh. After orbiting and locating the forward air controller's position and ensuring that we did have the correct forward air controller, he rolled in and marked a target on the side of a small hill, approximately 4 miles south of the field. As the mark was billowing up over the hill, he indicated I was cleared to start in on my run. I rolled in on my run, carrying six Delta One Alphas and four Delta Nines, with my switches set up to ripple the snake eyes across the target on the first run. My speed was 450 knots. It was a low-level run. I rolled in approximately 2,000 feet, leveling out about 500 meters out from the target from a final run-in heading, jinxing on the way down, leveling for the last part of the run. As I rolled level, I requested permission to fire. I had received no permission to drop, and a tremendous amount of traffic on the radio at that time. The forward air controller did not clear me, so I elected to pull the airplane up and take it around. Just as I pulled the nose up off of the target, I noticed a heavy stream of fire coming out of the target position, and as the nose lifted up into the sky with about a 4G pullout, I felt a tremendous hit in the center of the aircraft. As the airplane was hit, immediately the aircraft burst into flames and started to tumble, with the rear of the aircraft proceeding in an upward arc over the front of the nose. As the aircraft started to tumble, I lost all control of the flight system and immediately attempted to right the aircraft by applying full right rudder. This, of course, was no avail, and as the airplane spun around, my RIO ejected, which I found out later. He ejected on the first turn. On the second flip, I realized that the aircraft was mortally struck and there was no way to recover. The cockpit was engulfed in flames and smoke, and I used the alternate handle on the Martin Baker ejection seat to egress an aircraft. I waited until the proper moment to egress, and then I knew I was flipping, and I wanted to eject in an upward moment. So as I noticed the land, trees, and sky come around, I made up my mind the second time I saw the sky again, I would go ahead and eject. I did so, and the ejection was smooth and as advertised. As I ejected, I realized I was quite close to the ground, and as I started to look up to see if all the panels in my chute were intact, I hit the ground and rolled over in the heavy 8 to 9 foot elephant grass. The chute settled back down on the grass, and I sat up and felt my legs and my arms and shoulders to see that I was in good health, and I was in fact feeling fine at that time. After surveying my situation, I realized I was in a small valley on the side of a hill in high elephant grass and in relatively good condition. I had a sharp pain in the back of my spine, which I realized was possibly because of the compression during the ejection, but I appeared to be functioning normally and I could get up and walk. I proceeded away from the scene of the touchdown point, approximately 30, 40 feet down into the valley floor, making my way through the grass. On taking off my helmet, I heard heavy weapons fire from south-southwest to my position, and also the light crack of a 50 caliber or something to that effect type machine gun. Keeping low in the grass, I moved away from the parachute, thinking that possibly the enemy would spot the chute and converge on the position. As I moved away, I realized there was a great deal of aerial activity, and I looked up and spotted a helicopter. I proceeded back up to the chute area to pick up my flares and other pieces of equipment that I might need out of my seat pan, opened the seat pan, pulled out a flare, and popped a day smoke. A helicopter above me at about 200 feet gave me a thumbs up, circled further west, and disappeared out of my line of vision. I waited patiently for 3 or 4 minutes and then realized that the helicopter was coming in from the west and he was looking for me in the grass. I popped one more smoke and it proceeded directly over my position and hovered about 10 feet in the air. Due to the angle on the side of the hill, some brush, trees, and what have you, he could get no closer down to me than about 6 feet. The bottom of his landing skag was right about the limits of my reaching upward, and this is as close as he could get to the ground. I stood there patiently with all my equipment on, waiting for him to throw out a hoist rope with a clip on the end to hoist me up into the helicopter, and as I looked up, I realized he had no hoist equipment aboard. He threw a rope which had no clip on the end. I was momentarily befuddled because all the training we've ever had indicated that the helicopters would have a hoist equipment, and they would throw a hook out, and you would hook it to your torso harness, and they would rapidly pull you into the aircraft. But this rope was about a one-inch piece of rope, half-inch piece of rope, green nylon with no clip on the end of any sort. He threw it out to me, and he indicated to wrap it around my body, which I did. I wrapped it around my body and up through my hoist and tied a small knot in it. A crew member in the back attempted to pull me up into the helicopter, which, because of my weight, I weigh approximately 195 pounds with about 35 pounds of equipment on, which takes me up in the, I'd say, 230-pound area. He couldn't lift me. So I untied the rope at his request, and he lowers the aircraft down further and reached out with both hands, and it got a hold of my wrist. With him holding on my wrist, I attempted to throw my leg up over the landing skag and climb into the helicopter. As we lifted up 7-8 feet in the air, his grip on my wrist slipped, and down I went into the grass on the side of the hill on my back. Picked myself up again and re-signaled to him to throw out the rope, which he did. I re-tied myself securely with it, and he started to pull me up again to no avail. So, of course, at this time I was becoming a little concerned. I heard some automatic weapons fire, but saw no evidence that we were taking fire in our area. I tried to get him to come down lower to me, but he couldn't because of the angle of the hill and the grass. However, he did come in a little closer, and throw out another rope with a sling on it. This sling type affair was set up so you could put your feet into it and your arms, and I did and made one Herculean effort to leap as he pulled me up and grabbed the bottom edge of the door of the helicopter. As I had hold of the bottom edge of the door, I pulled myself up in a chinning position, and he grabbed the back of my torso harness and dragged me into the helicopter face first. At that moment, the pilot banked the helicopter into a hard left bank, and we proceeded down the valley on into basic caisson, where he dropped me off near the medical facility there at the southwest of the field. I still did not know whether my RIO had ejected satisfactorily from the aircraft, because at the moment we were hit and started to tumble, I tried to signal him through the radio to get out, but there was a dead circuit. There was no sound, no side tone earphones, and I wasn't sure whether he'd made it or not. After landing at caisson and going into the medical area, I had a few aspirin and sat down, being very careful not to bend over due to the pain in my back. Within minutes, another helicopter dropped him off, and we had a reunion there at caisson. A few things as far as lessons to be learned out of this incident. We found out and realized that low-level, high-speed aircraft using snakes and napes are extremely vulnerable to the automatic weapons on the ground without any forward-firing ordnance. Since this time, my squadron, at my direction, has been carrying 19-shot rocket pods on the left turret, and when the weather conditions permit, ceiling is adequate to fire rockets. The first run on in with the forward air controller's permission, we blanket the area with 38 2.75 rockets, and the number two man comes in and uses his snakes and napes at the direction of the forward air controller. This way, we get very good automatic weapon fire suppression and any flak suppression in the area. Another thing, we jinx hard on the way in and keep our minimum exposure, our exposure down to a minimum, and make sure we do the best we can to get our bombs right on target. Another thing, all my pilots have been briefed to learn how to tie a secure knot in the torso harness pickup clip that we have in the event that an Army helicopter comes by and picks you up without the advantage of using the lift top device that the Jolly Greens have or the Navy and Marine helicopters. Another thing which I can't stress enough is for the pilots, crew members, to be in good physical condition, because there's going to be certain times when they're going to be required to escape and evade and or lift themselves into positions or climb where they can get into a helicopter that possibly can't get down low enough to afford them a step-in type rescue. After returning to Chile, it took some time to find out who my benefactors were and who the pickup team was, and I found out that it was a warrant officer who was a member of the 176th Aviation Company located on the eastern side of the field at Chile. On discussion with him, I realized that my pickup was a matter of extreme good fortune to me, in that he was the only one that saw my chute after the aircraft burst into flames. He had been waiting at Khe Sanh to fly a Lieutenant Colonel Special Forces individual back down to Da Nang when he observed me take a hit and the aircraft burst into flames. And as the aircraft was engulfed in flames, he saw my chute egress out of it, the seat and myself and the chute, and land on the side of the hill. He immediately leaped off the ground at Khe Sanh with his helicopter and proceeded directly to my position. I estimate my time on the ground no more than about 10 minutes, and without his expeditious action, I am sure that it might have been an extremely difficult pickup. The man's name is Warrant Officer Branch. I've talked to him at length. I've written a letter to his command asking that they meritoriously award him and his crew some recognition because of their devotion to duty and their heroism under combat fire conditions. He told me he was going to stay with me just as long as possible in order to get me out. And he was beginning to consider asking me to move further down the valley floor so he could get in closer to me, but I finally got into the helicopter and everything worked out fine. My IO was picked up by a Marine helicopter with the advantage of using a hoist, and his pickup was classic right out of the book with no problems whatsoever.